This is episode 62 of Beyond the Bulletin. Hello and welcome to episode 62 of Beyond the Bulletin. I'm Brandon Sweet, editor of the Daily Bulletin.
And for Media Relations, I'm Pamela Smythe.
We're coming to you from our homes where we're practicing physical distancing. Thank you for joining us as we go Beyond the Bulletin.
And just like every week, we'll talk about some of the top stories featured in the Daily Bulletin and look ahead to see what's on the horizon, both inside and outside Ring Road.
We'll also hear from people and personalities on campus about key issues that matter.
This week, a first for us, we'll have two interviews. Today, my guests are Sarah Marsh, a PhD student, and Jeff Casello, Associate Vice President of Graduate and Postdoctoral Affairs. They're speaking with me about the Committee to Organize UWaterloo's campaign for unionization for teaching assistants, research assistants, and sessional instructors.
And before we get going today, Pamela, I'd like to say welcome back.
Thank you, Brandon. It's great to be back.
Yeah, so to make up for the fact that I was the interviewer last time, you get to interview two people this week instead of just one. That's
great.
Double
your pleasure.
Double your fun. So here's what's been happening. The university has announced a new protocol to track COVID cases on campus. President Ferdinand Hamdaloper made this announcement in a mass email to campus on Wednesday, October 7th. As of October 1st, the university is posting information provided by public health units on positive cases of COVID-19 amongst Waterloo students and employees who attended one of our campuses.
A new online dashboard will track confirmed positive cases and keep a complete record of cases as they're reported. President Hamdaloper says, "We will continue to follow public health guidance on specific cases to ensure that every individual at risk of infection knows what to do."
In reporting on positive cases, the university will seek to protect the private health information of individuals. You should check the disclosure protocol for what to do if someone reveals to you that they've tested positive for COVID-19.
The president notes that since March, public health units have confirmed a total of 5 positive cases of employees or students who visited campus. In all cases, the risk to other individuals was deemed to be low, and public health informed the close contacts of the affected individuals. Within the last few days, Region of Waterloo Public Health informed the university of one individual from our community who tested positive for COVID-19. The individual is in self-isolation, and public health officials are in the process of contacting relevant close contacts.
The university is encouraging everyone to continue to take all necessary precautions by washing your hands, practicing physical distancing when you have to go out, and by wearing a mask in public spaces. The university requires employees and students to monitor daily for symptoms of COVID-19, and if you're visiting campus, you must first complete the COVID-19 self-assessment online, which can also be found in the WatSafe app. This self-assessment is only meant as an aid and cannot diagnose you with COVID-19. If you have medical questions, contact your healthcare provider or your local public health unit.
Remember, warriors protect warriors. We're all in this together. What other slogan is applicable here, Brandon? I like diamonds are a girl's best friend.
Oh, yes.
In all situations.
On Monday, October 5th, Mary Ann Sim began her role as the Director of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs. Mary Ann joins the University of Waterloo from Brescia University College, which is affiliated with Western University, where she most recently held the position of Vice Principal of Students. Her portfolio covered recruitment and admissions, the Registrar's Office, academic advising, student life and housing, campus ministry, and communications.
Welcome aboard, Mary Ann.
For some of you listening, it may have been a while since you last came to the Waterloo campus, but the next time you visit via the University Avenue entrance, you will see that the new welcome sign is decked out in a 3-piece suit. Yes, the welcome sign at our South Campus entrance is now a towering 3-piece structure fashioned from aluminum and glass and creates a unique aesthetic and signature look that ties into the campus wayfinding program. Its shape, colors, and materials are intended to provide an eye-catching first contact with the visual language used on a multitude of sign types across campus. The program includes maps, trail markers, location and building signs, as well as directional signs.
The new welcome sign and wayfinding program are both designed to improve the arrival and navigation experience for visitors to our campus. Future phases of the program will include interior and digital wayfinding.
And while we're on the subject of taglines, remember that no matter where you go, there you are. For more information, visit the Campus Wayfinding Program's website at uwaterloo.ca/wayfinding.
And if there's a fork in the road, take it.
Now, here's what's coming up.
You are cordially invited to join the University of Waterloo in partnership with the Kitchener Public Library for an online community lecture entitled America Votes, What Should We Expect?
Wait, there's an election coming up? I hadn't noticed.
You know, with all of the October surprises so far, I'm surprised anyone wants to venture an educated guess.
I've heard October described as an October surprise advent calendar, because that's how it's going. As our neighbors to the south prepare for their November election, Waterloo researchers will discuss potential social, political, and economic impacts for Canada and the world. The event's moderator is Diane Vernier, a former broadcaster and one-time MPP for Kitchener Centre. Analysts include Professor Jerry Boychuk of the Department of Political Science and Professor Robert Danish of the Department of Communication Arts. You know, Professor Boychuk was my master's research paper supervisor when I was a graduate student here at Waterloo.
And he lived to tell the tale. The event is free, but you must register in advance. The event takes place on Tuesday, October 27th, online from 7 till 8 p.m. To learn more about the event, visit the Community Relations and Events website.
Well, Thanksgiving weekend is upon us, and that means it's time for Fall Reading Week.
Even though it's October, I'm still not ready for that particular F word.
I hear you. This is the second of a 3-year reading break pilot. Fall Reading Week will provide Waterloo undergraduate and graduate students a 9-day break in their course schedules from Saturday, October 10th, through to Sunday, October 18th. Classes, labs, exams, assignment due dates, and other course components will not be scheduled during Fall Reading Week. But of course, the pandemic has made this year's edition one to remember. The University of Waterloo has issued a word or two of caution to students in advance of the upcoming break, with messages from both President Farhan Hamdallahpour and Associate Vice President Academic Dave Davidi. The university is recommending that students avoid all travel throughout fall term and including during Fall Reading Week and the December break.
Any travel, regardless of the distance, is risky for you and your loved ones. In his memo to students this week, President Hamdallahpour urges students to keep their social bubbles small and to stay safe wherever they are taking their rest.
And this certainly applies to faculty and staff over the Thanksgiving weekend as well. If you have plans to leave Canada, you are required to quarantine for 14 days upon your return. This means you need to plan for how and where you will quarantine. Remember that students living in residence are not allowed to quarantine in their residence rooms upon their return from travel, as resident spaces do not meet quarantine requirements and therefore put others at risk.
If you live away from campus, you need to talk to your housemates about your plan to make sure you can quarantine without putting anyone at risk. You must check out the COVID-19 travel and quarantine checklist for information on creating a quarantine plan.
Now, if you plan to visit family or friends during Fall Reading Week or the December break, please ensure that you follow all government regulations and public health guidelines and review our Return to Campus Guide for updated information.
Fall Reading Week resources are available to help faculty, staff, and student leaders advise students on expectations, available resources and services, and ideas on how they might choose to spend their time off. The Student Success Office has also compiled Fall Reading Week resources for students.
All that said, we hope that students will enjoy their break safely and responsibly.
We sure do.
Now, in a similar vein, while not all faculty and staff will get the reading week off, there is a long weekend coming up. As I said before, it's Thanksgiving time, and that means we need to talk turkey about campus closings over the long weekend. The Student Life Center will be closed for the Thanksgiving holiday on Monday, October 12th, and will reopen on Tuesday, October 13th at 7:30 a.m. Food services operations are closed for Holiday Monday and for the remainder of Fall Reading Week, with the exception of the market at UWP in Claudette Miller Hall. All W Store, W Store Essentials, and W Print locations will be closed on Monday for Thanksgiving and will have modified hours for Reading Week next week. But as always, there are a few essential university services that never shut down. UW Police, reachable at 519-888-4911 or extension 22222. And the Plant Operations Maintenance Emergencies Hotline at extension 33793.
Check out the Daily Bulletin on Friday, October 9th for a full listing of what's open and closed on Monday, October 12th.
And now the interview. Or should I say interviews? For technical reasons, we have to bring you our two guests separately instead of together. First up, Sarah Marsh is a PhD student in the Department of Germanic and Slavic Studies. She's also one of the leads on the committee to organize UWaterloo. She spoke with Pamela about the campaign to unionize some academic workers at UWaterloo and what's behind it.
Sarah, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Pamela.
What led to this call to unionize?
There's been a lot of rumblings for a long time. The current drive really got going last year. There was discussions at the GSA. Laurier had just unionized, and this process was ongoing when the pandemic hit and a grassroots group of students decided to get together and to get the ball rolling.
So who's included here?
So we're including all academic workers at UW, including graduate student teaching assistants, research assistants, and sessionals who are students, as well as non-student sessionals. Undergraduate academic workers can also join, although they're not the main group for our campaign. Basically, any contract sessionals or adjuncts, et cetera, postdocs who aren't represented by FAO, who have a contract under a year, we're focused on student workers and academic workers.
What happens at other institutions?
So at almost every other institution in Canada, there's a union, and it sets out a clear, mutually agreed upon, bargained agreement that people have voted to approve, a contract between the workers and the employer. So they have the clarity and the transparency of expectations, of standards that we don't have. Every other university has this, and we have students who come to grad school at Waterloo and are surprised that we aren't unionized because we're basically the only ones. They come from all over and they say, why don't we have these same protections that other schools have? Like U of T, York, Queens, Western, you name it.
You use the word protection. So normally when groups call for unionization, that's because there are things that they feel need improving or addressing, protecting. If that's the case here, what are they?
So there are many, many, many issues. But the reason I use the word protection is that what a union does is it gives you a legally enforceable contract that's clear. And that offers protections that university policies don't offer. Every student right now has to try to raise issues individually. And what we're looking for is for students to have a democratic group, which is what a local union is, a democratic group where everyone gets together, talks about their working conditions and says, we want to have a say. We want to be on a more equal footing with the university. We want to have our work recognized as work, as essential to the university. You know, over 50% now of undergraduate teaching is done by non-tenure track faculty at universities in Canada. And that includes graduate students, that includes sessionals and adjuncts and precarious faculty.
Why do you say that you want it to be recognized as essential work? Because I feel like the university is on the record as saying that the contributions are important.
So they do say that, which is great. But when you look at the lived experiences of students, we're often told at certain times, you're an employee, you have to pay taxes, you have to do this, you have to do that. And other times when we question things, we're told, well, you're just a student. You're not a worker. You're learning. You're an apprentice. You know, I get to tell you what to do. And so there's a disconnect between the lived experiences of students on the ground and, you know, what the university aspires to in their messaging. Students from abroad or even from other provinces or even from Ontario may not understand their rights. And a big part of a union is educating workers about their rights, human rights, social rights under the collective agreement, which we don't have a collective agreement. But that's why, you know, it's admirable that the university says that. But, you know, you have sessionals. I know a sessional who's worked here for 7 years and has never had a contract longer than 4 months or 8 months. They don't get benefits. I know students who have been pushed around from here to there to everywhere because they can't get accessibility accommodations for their work as a TA. And they've reached their hours halfway through the term and they just have to keep working. And so all of these things are happening and they're being treated as individual issues, not as systemic issues. And what a union does is it gives a structure, a voice for people to get together and say, you know, what is important to us as a group to make those connections, to bridge those gaps.
So TAs have, say, an agreement at the beginning of their employment period that they'll put in X number of hours, and then they meet or exceed those hours, are they compensated?
Basically, it's very disparate across different departments. Some departments, students track their hours, others they don't. We have students who are way under their hours, they still get the same pay. Students who are way over, it's essentially treated as a salary. There's never any check-in. There's no standard even contract form for outlining the expectations for the TA. There's a suggested one from the website of the GSPA, but every department and faculty kind of does things their own way. And this leaves open opportunities for inconsistency, for unfairness, for overwork, where, you know, I know many students who work way beyond their hours because they feel they have to. Professors are the ones who write their job recommendations, and students want to work hard. They want to put in their time. They want to do the work that needs to be done for their for TAing, but they don't have the ability to push back on that. Or sometimes they don't even know that they can. They think that's just the way it is. That 160 hours, which is way higher than many other universities, is just a suggestion. And I just have to do whatever my professor says or whatever my faculty says.
Well, how would unionizing change that? Because even whether you're in a union or not, it's still the supervisor who's going to be writing your letter of recommendation.
So first of all, what it would do is would create transparent standards across the university for how many hours a TA ship is, for what the pay is, and it would be enforceable under the law. So basically, there would have to be a lot of structures in place to ensure that those contracts are being adhered to. And those structures right now are typically not there, or they're inconsistent. Other universities have ways to make sure that students are not working more than their hours. For example, a number of universities have agreed in their bargaining that they have floater TAs. So they're not assigned to a specific course. They are there so that if you've maxed out your hours, they'll help with that. They can also help students with disabilities who maybe take longer to do the same tasks. So they need some backup, you know, and then you also have students who are working less, maybe, who are then being held responsible and being forced to kind of, you know, do their part too.
What are the things that the committee to organize UWaterloo would like to see? Is there a laundry list? Pardon the language, but is there a list of items that you would like to see addressed?
We can give examples, but it's important to know that we're a group of students who are not elected. Once the unionization happens, then there will be open elections among union members for executives and for bargaining committee, and they will do consultations across the university for student workers and sessional workers to find out what their priorities are in an agreement. So, you know, we can give things that we think are issues, but fundamentally it has to be a democratic process of saying, this is what we agree is a priority for us. And right now it's hard to say because we don't have all the information from every department. We don't know what they're doing here and there and everywhere. And part of the union is to get together and really say, okay, how is it in every single department? So for sessionals, the job security is very much one of the key issues, I would suspect. I've worked as a sessional, so I can say that from my personal experience. Also benefits. For graduate students, I would just say there are some patterns, but a lot of the issues are really dependent on the department. For example, in arts, you're not going to have issues with labs. We don't have labs. And, you know, chemical safety or something like that. There are some specific issues department by department, but the overwhelming thing for us is clarity and consistency, fairness, for example, in access to TA ships, fair processes for how those are assigned, accountability, like I said, for the number of hours you're working. Those are some of the things that really I would say cut across departments.
You mentioned parental leave. Mm-hmm. They don't currently, if you're a TA or an RA, a research assistant, you don't have parental leave?
You can take a leave of absence. You would lose your funding and then have to apply for a grant, which has a few aspects that are restrictive, but quite a few students can get the grant, but you can't get, for example, EI usually because you don't have enough hours. So, and the problem with the system right now that I see is that it's in 4 month chunks and babies don't come on 4 month chunk schedules. You know, they might come 1 week into the term or, you know, there's not a lot of flexibility there. And it also means, you know, going on a leave of absence is a big decision. The issue with parental leave is partly the grants that are offered that are not guaranteed. So you don't know if you're going to get it before you go on leave.
What kind of response are you getting from grad students, TAs, research assistants that know about this drive?
Yeah, so I won't lie. It's not been easy to reach out to people. People are very distracted by the pandemic right now. They're coping. They're trying to manage their daily lives. So it's been a bit slow going. But we've seen a lot of momentum recently. And every time we get the word out there somehow, whether that's through something like this or in another way, people flock to us. So the demand is there. And we've found that overwhelmingly students are either immediately on board, or once you chat with them about their issues and they ask their questions about what, you know, what could realistically a union actually do, they almost always end up signing a card. So we're really focused on one-on-one conversations, but we've had a very positive response. Sessionals are overwhelmingly signing up. I mean, they're extremely precarious. And, you know, right now with the pandemic, a lot of departments have completely frozen all sessional hiring. So, you know, they're really struggling. And it's really the pandemic has on the one hand made it harder to reach people, but on the other hand made it even more urgent because it's exposed that precarity and how many students were really barely hanging on. You know, studies have found that graduate students are 6 times more likely to have mental health problems than the general population. I think it's up to 25% have symptoms of depression and anxiety. I think the suicide rate is also, or the suicidal ideation rate is also much higher than the general population. And this is because of isolation. This is because of even before the pandemic, isolation, stress, pressure, insecurity of kind of transitioning into this new role from a student to a professor. I could go on about that forever, but
where do those numbers come from? What's the source?
So I read about that study in an article in Inside Higher Ed, and it's referring to, among other studies, a 2018 paper in Nature Biotechnology by Evans, Beera, Gastelum, Weiss, and Vanderford called Evidence for a Mental Health Crisis in Graduate Education.
Hmm. You're a counselor in the Graduate Student Association. How would a union affect the GSA?
The union is not the same as a GSA, but at many schools, they do work hand in hand because they have a lot of shared interests. So the GSA represents all students and they're focused on the academic experience and the experience of graduate students, whereas a union is focused on advocacy for students as workers. It shouldn't really impact anything the GSA does fundamentally. A GSA can do a lot, and they've done a lot of really great work to advocate for students at Waterloo, but they don't have the legal protections as a certified bargaining agent that a union would have. So they can negotiate and make agreements with the university, but the university can change those at any time at their own will. So we don't have evidence of that happening, but we've seen that change takes a long time to come. You know, when going through the process at the GSA, and that for example, the language in Policy 30 is still not as strong as even a basic collective agreement would be. We're hoping to be able to work together with the GSA. They've endorsed our drive overwhelmingly. Council voted to approve. They believe that it's in the best interest of graduates. And it would also take a big chunk of things off of the GSA's plate. Anything workplace related, they basically won't have to deal with anymore. They can focus in on the academic experience, the social experience, the services that they offer to students.
So you referred to Policy 30, which is the university's policy called Employment of Graduate Student Teaching Assistants. Are there any issues with that policy currently?
It's a policy. It's not a collective agreement. So in my view, it's just nowhere near as comprehensive as it needs to be. It's not that there's anything particularly terrible in there. It's just insufficient. So it doesn't capture all of the issues in the way that a CA would.
What is involved in unionizing and where are you at in the process?
Sure. So right now we're doing what's called a card signing campaign. And it's called that because traditionally it was these little paper cards that people would sign. And this, what this card means is you're saying, I want to join the union if it's formed. And I'm pledging my support. I want to join. You can go to our website, which is organizeuw.org. And there's a link there. We also have really extensive FAQs, which we're constantly updating to give all the information because we can't do as much in person. So we've really focused on having a very extensive online presence that normally in a typical campaign wouldn't necessarily be necessary. So once we get 40, minimum by law, 40% of workers in the proposed group to sign a card saying they want to have a union, we will file with the labor board. They will do a reconciliation process. Waterloo, the employer, never sees who signed. It's all separate through the tribunal. Mm-hmm. Once they certify that, then a week later, there will be an online vote and all workers can vote yes or no if they want to have a union. And we need 50% plus one for that to pass. Then we could start the process of forming a local, having elections, having a bargaining committee, any other committees we want, international students, equity, et cetera, and that process.
So it's a lengthy process.
It is. You know, I recognize I may not still be here when that happens, and I might not benefit from it personally. But to me, it's important enough that I'll feel like I made Waterloo a better place for students, even if in the end I'm not here anymore.
Are there any other points that you want to make before we go?
I would just like to make the point that our campaign is very open to anyone who has questions, no matter how, you know, seemingly small or perhaps anti-union even. I love to talk to people who are anti-union and to hear what you have to say, even if you decide not to sign a card in the end and I can't convince you. We have a lot of events coming up in the fall term. We just held a webinar and the video is available on our website, and that was on introduction to unionization and a focus on health and safety. We're looking to have two more issue-focused webinars, hopefully soon, on equity and access on campus and international student issues. Okay. We have a weekly drop-in Q&A that's open. The link is on our website as well. You can go there. You can meet some of us, talk to us, ask questions, say hello. The URL is organizeuw.org.
Well, Sarah Marsh, we will put a link to your website in our show notes on SoundCloud. Thank you so much for being here and sharing your perspectives.
Thank you so much for having me, Pamela. I really appreciate the opportunity.
For the university administration's perspective, Pamela is joined by Professor Jeff Casello. He's the Associate Vice President of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs.
Jeff Casello, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Pip.
So what is the university's position on this initiative of the Committee to Organize UWaterloo?
So the university really is eager to have students feel supported, to have opportunities to represent themselves, and to really create a very good place to be a graduate student. And so the university's position is that we work exceptionally well now with our graduate student representation. Do we have issues to work on? Absolutely. But we feel like the process that is in place at the moment, where we work collectively, collaboratively with the graduate students themselves and with the graduate students' leadership through the Graduate Student Association, is the best way to achieve both the university's, but more importantly, the students' goals.
And what would be the issue for the university if there was approval to unionize?
I think it would transformatively change the way in which we were able to interact with our graduate students. I'll just give you an example. I have a number of PhD students that I'm supervising. And if we were in a unionized environment, the very kind of collaborative, collegial conversations that often happen between me and my graduate students, I think would be different, in the sense that the same student who I'm mentoring and supervising on the other side of the table would be represented by an institution other than the university. And that would put boundaries on the kinds of things that I would be able to talk to my students about, or at least the kinds of things that would maybe I would feel comfortable having conversations with them. And I think the same would be true for the students. So, you know, the real issue is, I think, what's the best way to achieve students' goals? And is it through collaborative collegial work in partnership with the university, with advocates that are at the university? Or is it better to be represented by an external body? And that's, you know, fundamentally the question that unionization raises.
You had mentioned that if there were a union, it would change the way that you would be able to communicate with your TAs, I guess, and your research assistants. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. So, you know, imagine that I'm teaching a course and the student who is my TA, who is working with me to deliver that course, suppose they're having a comprehensive exam that term, and they ask, can I redistribute my hours in that term so that I can do a little bit more work up front and then have an opportunity to take some time away to prep for my comp exam? And that's the kind of decision that happens all the time on campus between our students and the folks with whom they're serving as a TA. In a unionized environment, that kind of conversation would be regulated, I would suspect, and it would be maybe more difficult to have those kinds of one-off communications or collegial or collaborative ways to get to a positive outcome for students. And, you know, I think that there certainly are times when students make those requests of their instructors and they're not respected. I think that's problematic. But I do think that there are times when those things are happening, and I wouldn't want that ability to work collectively to be seen as partners in the delivery of our academic mission to be changed because of the presence of a union.
At many post-secondary institutions in Canada, teaching assistants, grad research assistants, and contractor sessional instructors are unionized. So we really are an exception. Why do you think that is?
I think if you look at the way all of the groups on campus interact with the university administration, whether we're talking about faculty, about staff, or our students, we have a long history of being successful and working collaboratively and really solving problems associated with the issues that arise for each of those cohorts. Our faculty relations committee is exceptionally productive. Our staff relations committee the same way. And our graduate student relations committee is one that I get to co-chair with the Graduate Student Association president. We have great representation from students. We have a direct conduit to the GSA Council now with many of the members around the GSRC, the Graduate Student Relations Committee table, also representing themselves on the GSA and their constituents on the GSA Council. So I think we have a long history and a long successful history of being able to address the issues that are of concerns for the university's constituents and doing it in the, as I keep saying, I guess, the collegial and collaborative way. Certainly when a student is helping to deliver the academic mission for the university, acting as a TA, for example, they take on a certain role and they have requirements. And it does look in many ways like employment. So there are deadlines, there are tasks to be done, there is compensation and so on. But the way that the university perceives that is that this is a shared responsibility between the instructor and the TA to really help the university achieve its goals of educating the next set of students. And yep, there's employment-like elements there. But for us, or for me particularly, my feeling is that that educational mission works best when the TA and the instructor are on the same page. They're trying to achieve the same mission, and they're trying to really educate students in a meaningful way. And when you introduce this formal labor relationship between the instructor and the TA, that changes that dynamic, and there's less flexibility. There's less opportunities, I think, for them to really be of the like mind. And I think that's what gives me the most concern. You know, I've taught dozens of courses in my time at Waterloo, and I've always valued the contributions of my TAs. And I think many of my peers and colleagues feel exactly the same way. We just can't reach students in the same way that TAs can. They're nearer in age, they're nearer in thought process, and they play such an important role that I wouldn't want to feel like every interaction I had with that TA would be somehow governed by an external relationship that neither I nor the TA have really an active hand in creating.
But Jeff, there are cases though where these workers say that they feel like they're being treated unfairly. For instance, working way more hours than they're contracted for and paid for. That's one of the issues at the heart of this drive. What is the university doing to address those kinds of concerns?
The university is really concerned about that issue to the point that we opened up some years ago Policy 30, which is the policy that governs the relationship between instructors and TAs. And we've largely rewritten that policy with support from graduate students and from the graduate studies community. And the policy now in draft form that is going through its final approvals is really principle driven. And the principles include student agency so that when it's time to be engaged as a TA, the students have some agency in identifying their skill sets and the courses for which they're going to be matched. They have some agency in establishing expectations with the instructor when the course is beginning. They have agency with the instructor to report out on the hours that they've already committed to the course and be able to forecast ahead whether or not they're going to exceed those hours and develop strategies to correct those kinds of situations. And so I think that our students will see that this policy really has heard that concern and has taken really positive steps to achieving outcomes that I think that are going to address many of the students' concerns.
Now, I was speaking with Sarah Marsh just before we started talking, and she had said that that policy, there's no real legal backing for it. If you had a collective agreement, the university is legally bound to adhere to certain things. But the policy, the university could just say, you know, we're not going to do that. And how likely is it the university wouldn't honor its agreement through the policy?
Yeah, so the university is governed by policy. We don't have a collective bargaining agreement with any of our, we have a small subset, I think, of represented workers on the campus. But typically, we operate on policy. And so when there is a breach of ethical behavior, for example, Policy 33, which is also newly rewritten, is the one that governs the relationship between the university and all of its members and their behavior on campus. And we follow that and we practice it. The university secretariat, their primary role is the development and enforcement of these policies. We're all bound by them. You know, I really, frankly, reject the notion that we would need a collective bargaining to govern ourselves. I think the evidence has been that for 65 years, the University of Waterloo has operated under a policy framework with great success.
Would the changes to Policy 30 allow for this flexibility that you were talking about earlier with your TAs?
Absolutely. In fact, it encourages it. It requires that instructors hear from the TAs. And, you know, the main principle is this, Pamela, that we want pedagogy to guide what happens in a relationship between the instructor and a TA. We want the student learning to be at the forefront. And if, for example, a student is having their comprehensive exam and that's the same week as the midterm exam, then we have to figure out that scheduling. But it should be figured out collectively, and that can be done amicably and it can be done productively between the student and the instructor. And that's what we hope is going to happen, and that's what the policy calls for.
Is that flexibility a double-edged sword, though? It can be a benefit to the employee, but can it also be a case where the employee is being asked to do something that maybe is unfair?
I don't ever imagine that we were going to have a situation where people would try to exploit our TAs in a way simply to the instructor's benefit. And in fact, if that were the case, and this is a really important point, if a student perceived that our policy is sufficiently structured and is officially sufficiently binding, that there is a pathway for the students to challenge that instructor's behavior. Now, we hope it doesn't get to that point. Mm-hmm. We hope it can be achieved, that resolution can be achieved in a more amicable way. But there doesn't need to be a collective bargaining agreement for a student to challenge that kind of behavior. In fact, we can deal with it directly under our policy.
So one of the things that the committee is saying is that with a union, it's, you know, the entire group, it's a collective, it's a change of culture. Whereas the current system right now, it's a student who has to take action individually and complain about somebody who may be writing them a letter of reference for a highly competitive job market. Mm-hmm. What do you say to that?
I can perceive that that feeling would be present in that relationship between supervisors and their students. The idea that that the university believes and that the culture at the university is creating is that there is student advocacy at every level of the university. And that starts with your supervisor if you're a research student. It starts with your program director if you are a course-based graduate student. It starts with your grad chair in your home department. So every department is structured where there is a chair of the department and an associate chair or an associate director whose primary responsibility is the well-being of graduate students. Then at the next level, there's a faculty associate dean that is to look after graduate students. And then at the center, my office and my team, along with a whole host of academic support units around the campus, are here to advocate on behalf of students as well. And I can tell you, Pamela, that we've had some really difficult cases come through my office and through department and faculty offices where there has been friction between students and their instructors with whom they're TAing or with their supervisors. And we've been really successful in resolving some really difficult cases. And this is going to sound a bit corny, but I can tell you that probably one of the most remarkable experiences for me is when I'm on the stage at convocation and when a student who's had a bumpy ride comes across that stage and completes their degree. For me, that is the single most rewarding thing that my job allows. And when I'm able to either work with my colleagues or by myself, get involved in these kinds of cases and advocate with students, do I want to get to a point where I don't have to advocate for students? Absolutely. But in the time that there needs to be student advocates, I'm eager to play that role, as is so many of the members of the graduate student community. So the idea that students are on their own in these issues is not consistent with my own experience. And this is something I think that the university, again, candidly can work on. We can continue to build this culture. But I think that the need for an external collective bargaining unit to represent students, in my opinion, isn't necessary. I think we have enough student advocacy at the local levels, at all levels of the university, to ensure that that students are well looked after.
Let's say they were doing 160 hours. They were supposed to work 160 hours, but they complete that in the first two-thirds of the term. So that one person goes and says, hey, I've done all this work and I still got much more to do and I'm not going to get paid. That's just going to address the concerns of that one person. So what is the university doing to make it a more level playing field?
a lot of these disagreements that, arise between graduate students and their instructors or their supervisors, it's really a lack of communication and a lack of expectation setting. We teach in our supervisory workshops that we provide along with the Center for Teaching Excellence. We actually recommend strongly to our faculty members that they do this exercise with students when they take them on as graduate students, where they sit down and they say, my expectation is that when I give you something to read, you'll turn it around in, and my expectation is 2 days, and the instructor or the supervisor's expectation is 10 days, and they come collaboratively and they agree that 5 days is what the expectation should be between them. We do the same thing now with TA placements, where at the beginning of each TA ship, there is a set of expectations that are set out. Is the TA expected to conduct to be engaged in any training? Is the TA expected to come to class? When will the midterm be, and how many hours should we dedicate to that? Do you want me to be part of the final exam writing? Do you want me to proctor it? Do you want me to mark that? And all of those things are laid out in advance of the course starting so that both the instructor and the TA have that expectation. So the scenario that you provided where a student's two-thirds of the way through the class and has already spent 160 hours should never happen, because the expectation should be set out in front. And in fact, is required to be set out in front through the new policy that we've created. So the university has, in collaboration with the faculties, has published a guide to graduate student supervision, and this is available on the GSPA webpage. And I really encourage students to take a look at this, and faculty members to take a look at this. That document lays out, I think, quite clearly what the expectations are of supervisors and the roles that they should play. It lays out the expectations for students and what agency they have in the roles that we expect them to play. And if we actually follow this guidance that's in that document, when we do that, again, the likelihood of differences of expectation entering into any kind of relationship, whether it's a supervisory relationship or a TA relationship, should be minimized. But I think, Pamela, the real key thing is that students feel empowered to act on their own behalf, that they feel like they have advocacy at all levels of the university, and that they also feel like they have a formal policy backing that they can point to when they need to have a support for the kind of advocacy they're seeking. And I think that those three elements are in place at the University of Waterloo.
And you have a new website.
We do. We want to make sure that students know that there is a process by which we hear you, we vet your concerns, and we report those out. And that website is uwaterloo.ca/graduate-relations. So I encourage our student colleagues to take a look there. There's lots of good and timely and frequently updated information. Through that webpage, Pamela, there is a link that sends me directly an email. If there is something on a graduate student's mind, if you send something through that to me, you have 100% certainty that I'm going to receive it, that I'm going to communicate to you that I've received it, and then I'm going to put it in the hands of the people who can help address those concerns. I'm also now on Twitter, which is an exciting change for me. Jeff Cosello has his own Twitter handle where he's talking quite a lot about graduate student issues. So this is another way for students to contact me directly through Twitter. The university is also engaged in a supervisory assessment. And so we've done quite a lot of work looking at what good graduate student supervision looks like and how to identify problematic graduate student supervision. So that's a report that my office has led that will present recommendations to both the provost and the faculty deans.
What's the timeline on that?
So the draft report is in my inbox, Pamela. So as soon as I get a day or two to sit and read through that report, it'll be in the hands of the provost. The students will know that the deans have made a commitment to addressing the issues of funding transparency. Those commitments from Dean's Council are available on the Graduate Relations webpage. But maybe the most important thing, Pamela, of all, is really that the graduate student voice in this, I'm proud to say, is as loud as it has been ever on the campus in the last 3, 4, 5 years. And that's a result of senior leadership's commitment to it from the president right on down. It is my office who for decades has been committed to graduate student well-being, but now we've taken an even more visible approach. The GSA leadership continues to be superb.
What you say you want Waterloo to be one of the best places in North America to be a grad student. How are we doing?
Yeah, so there's two data points that I can share with the community. The first is we did a very deep dive into funding, looking at how our students are supported compared to our peers. So each faculty identified programs or universities that they feel like they compete with for students. And I'm really proud to say that our funding levels in nearly all cases exceed those peer institutions. And it's not just at the average. Our upper bounds are higher than their upper bounds. Our averages are higher than their averages. But maybe most importantly, our lower bounds, so the minimum students are receiving, are higher than the minima in other peer institutions. We won a Canadian Association of Graduate Studies Award for making our programs more accessible to a diverse set of students. And that includes a daycare bursary that my office runs. It includes a parental leave bursary that my office administers. We have a contingency bursary with a budget that is, I think, in seven figures, that is dedicated to students who experience unexpected and unforeseen financial challenges. They can come and request support to bridge them until their financial well-being comes back together. Mm. These are all things that really, I think, are unique at the University of Waterloo. And I think, based on funding and on the financial resources that are available to our students, really do put us ahead of so many of our peer institutions.
Thank you very much, Jeff, for being here and for sharing your viewpoints today.
Well, Pamela, thanks for having me. And maybe I can just leave with one message that if a student is having what they feel like is an intractable situation, if there's something that's on their mind, something that's just bothersome, if it's not about geese, because I can't control the geese as much as I'd like to, please reach right out to me. You can find me on the graduate relations page. Be in touch and we'll work collaboratively on solving your problems.
Well, that about wraps it up for us this week. You can find all of our past shows and links about the items we mentioned in today's show on SoundCloud.com. To ensure you don't miss an episode, please subscribe to the Beyond the Bulletin podcast wherever you get your podcasts and recommend us to your colleagues and Waterloo alumni.
Please do, and remember to do your part to limit the spread of COVID-19 in your community.
And mask up when headed indoors in public spaces.
You can get in touch with us via email at bulletin@uwaterloo.ca.
Have a safe, socially distant Thanksgiving, and thanks for listening as we went Beyond the Bulletin.
You had said that the Star Wars holiday special was not Christmas as I thought. It was actually time for American Thanksgiving. And I remember just last week after the presidential debacle, Mark Hamill on Twitter said, "That was the worst thing I've ever seen, and I was in the Star Wars holiday special."
It doesn't get much more direct than that. It's an apt comparison, that's for sure.